Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, we interview veteran author Kai Bird. His 2005 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, was co-written with Martin Sharon, and it served as the inspiration for this year's Oscar-winning film, Oppenheimer. Bird talked about his life as a biographer with fellow Bio member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
I always find that if I'm going to do an interview with somebody, it's immensely helpful if they have written a memoir. And yours is called Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, about your childhood in Jerusalem, Cairo, Beirut, Saudi Arabia, and India. You were what we used to call, a diplomatic brat, like an army brat.
Right.
Moving around the world to new postings with your mom and dad for the State Department. So you didn't get the classic Friday night football, senior prom, teenage life. Your memoir shows you had amazing experiences riding Arabian horses over the sands of Saudi Arabia, gunfire in the night, scorpions in your bedroom, emergency evacuations. So I guess my question is, how has that early life affected your life and the path of your literary and journalistic career or your artistic sensibility?
Well, Jack, you've gotten right to the heart of my dark secret, which is that I'm not really an American. I didn't grow up with television. I didn't understand football or sports. I didn't understand American politics, but ostensibly I was an American. I was an expat. I thought of myself as an American, but when I came back to this country to go to college, I discovered I was a foreigner in my own land. Didn't know how to drive a car. I'd never really gone grocery shopping in a safe way. You know, America was a foreign land. And so I think to answer your question, I ended up sort of subconsciously drifting into journalism and then biography as a way to sort of figure out America. And that took me into, as I say, journalism. And eventually I decided to write a book, which turned out to be a biography.
Is there something about the outsider's perspective that lends itself to biography?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. You come with, I don't know, a more objective eye, but you come with more questions. You know, I recall when I was first exploring the notion of doing a biography of Jimmy Carter. This was 1990. I'd finished my biography of John McCloy. It had taken me 10 years. And I was interested in Carter. He was the first American president I could vote for in 1976. And he was sort of a mystery. He was a Southerner. He was a liberal, but I wasn't quite sure whether he was liberal enough. He certainly didn't seem to be as liberal as your man, Ted Kennedy. Anyway, I was curious about him. And my sort of rabbi and editor and mentor at The Nation, Victor Navasky, said, well, if you want to explore doing Jimmy Carter, you should go down to Georgia and do a magazine article for me, a profile of what Jimmy Carter is doing with his ex-presidency. So I took Victor up on this proposition, and I went down and spent 2 weeks in Georgia, and I got a telephone interview with Jimmy and interviewed a bunch of his people at the new Carter Center and did a nice, you know, 5,000-word magazine cover story. But I came away from that experience realizing that I didn't understand Georgia at all. It was really a foreign country. I didn't understand the language. I didn't understand Southern Baptists, their peculiar religiosity. I didn't understand race. And I certainly didn't understand where Jimmy Carter came from. So I came back and I told my wife, Susan, that if I was going to do this Jimmy Carter biography, we'd have to move down to South Georgia for 2 years and seep into the place and treat it like a foreign correspondent would. And Susan looked at me and she says, well, I'm not going down there. So that put a pause on that project for decades. And I didn't come back to it until 2015. And I never did move down to Georgia, but I guess I became more confident about being able to report on it from afar and through the archives. But yes, my experience as an expat cemented my understanding of myself as a foreigner, and that's helped me to write biography.
Why stick with it? What was it about biography that attracted you and has kept you in the field for most of your professional life?
Well, you know, I sort of stumbled into biography on my first book. I was interested in doing a history book about the Middle East and big American oil companies. And this was, you know, 1980. It was just after the 79 energy crisis. And I thought that's what I wanted to do. But as I got into the research, I stumbled across this guy, John J. McCloy, looked him up in Who's Who, and realized that not only was he a lawyer who represented all 22 American oil companies, and he had an antitrust waiver letter from the Justice Department so that he could do this, but he had done all these other things. He was a sort of power behind the scene, behind the throne. You know, he'd been an assistant secretary of war, chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Anyway, I realized that his story was a vehicle into what I was interested in talking about. He did indeed have his finger on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, but all sorts of other things. And then it grew and grew, and it became a full-scale biography, and I fell in love with biography. But, you know, several decades later, after I finished Oppenheimer, I was really interested in going back and exploring my childhood in the Middle East, and decided that I would use the vehicle of a childhood memoir to try to explain this complicated history of all the tribes and wars of my childhood. So that memoir is packed with history, but the vehicle that makes the reader be able to stick with it and turn the page, I think, is the fact that it's focused on this little American boy who happens to be growing up in Jerusalem and Beirut and Cairo and Saudi Arabia and then India. And when you see the world, you see the 56 war and the 67 war and the civil war of Jordan in 1970 and the hijackings, and you see all these historical events through my young eyes. And that provides a authenticity, I think, that is the same as in a biography, but memoir is different. Anyway, I think my memoir as such was informed by my skills at that point as a biographer. I really did a memoir with, as you can see from the book, a lot of footnotes. And a lot of it is based on the fact that my mother happened to keep all her correspondence. So we have letters in file folders every year, sort of explaining what's happening in Jerusalem in 1956, and also comments about my reaction as a little boy to what's happening. And
she's worried at one point, she talks about, she's worried about the Americanization of Kai.
That's right.
And you describe yourself as earnest, naive, and self-righteous to a fault. Shy, and your dad says you were shy and introverted. So this sounds like the classic combination of traits that would make an outsider foreign correspondent very skillful at analyzing the American establishment, which you did. I also thought that that book brought a great history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the history that you tell, which goes right back to the 1940s. And then it sort of ends. And then I picked up A Good Spy. And there's the second chapter of the Palestinian story that brings us not quite all the way to today, but a great part of the way. So this is a drama that you've been watching all your life.
Yeah, I still to this day, you know, I pick up the New York Times or the Washington Post, and if there's a story about the Middle East on the front page, that's the first thing I read.
But you managed to talk about a neighbor. Ames was a neighbor of
That's
yours
right.
in Saudi Arabia, and that enabled you to bring an additional perspective to what would ordinarily be a standard biography of a CIA agent.
Yeah, it was just a sort of stroke of happenstance, but he was my next door neighbor in Saudi Arabia. I thought he was a foreign service officer like my father, but when he was killed in Beirut in 1983 in the first truck bomb attack on a U.S. embassy, I read in the newspapers that he had been a very high-ranking clandestine CIA officer. And I turned to my father and asked about Bob Ames. And so, again, many years later, I was looking around for a new project and stumbled on the fact that there was a court case where the survivors of the Beirut embassy bombing had sued the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I looked up this testimony, and it was very graphic and vivid, and it included the testimony of the widow, Yvonne Ames. And I suddenly realized in those court documents, there was a way in to tell an unusual story about a clandestine CIA officer. And I won the cooperation of the widow, went down and interviewed her in North Carolina. And at one point in that long weekend, she said, "Oh, you know, I think maybe there are some letters that Bob wrote to me." And literally, it took 6 months to sort of pry these letters out of her. And it turned out there were like 150 pages of handwritten letters on yellow legal pad. And they were an incredible insight into the daily life of a clandestine CIA officer, what it's like, how boring it could be, how exciting, how dangerous. It was all of that. But it allowed an intimacy that you really struggle to achieve in a biography.
So you also have a history of probably the most successful collaboration on a biography and a disastrous collaboration. The McCloy book did not work out well, and the Oppenheimer book worked out spectacularly. So how did you become Martin Sherwin's partner? What had you learned, if anything at all, from the breakup with Max Holland over doing a McCloy book? Collaboration may sound good, but sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, that's sadly true. You know, when Marty Sherwin came to me in 1999, early 2000, and asked me to join him on his Oppenheimer Odyssey, which he'd been working on at that point for 20 years, doing massive amounts of research and very little writing. But he asked me to join him. I was unemployed. I didn't have a new book project. And I told Marty, "No, I can't do that. I like you too much." And I was serious. I did like him a lot. He was a funny guy, very witty, smart. He was fun to be around. But I knew that he had spent 20 years obsessing about Robert Oppenheimer. And I knew that was a good thing for a biographer, but it was his project. And I was very wary of joining him on it, precisely because my very first book, started out as a collaboration with my best friend. And sadly, about 8 years into it, it ended in sort of disaster where lawyers were called in and we had to sign a sort of, in effect, a divorce decree. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me.
I'm sorry to have to bring it up.
No, very mean of you. But it is instructive. It is, there aren't many biographies that are collaborations. And, I'm not quite sure even today what happened between my co-author on the McCloy book. But we each became properly obsessed with the subject and doing the research. And we just got on different timelines and went off in different directions. And I ended up writing a full draft of the book. And by that time, it was almost 10 years into the project, and there was no money. And Simon and Schuster and Alice Mayhew were getting impatient. And so I felt I couldn't spend any more time on it and ran with it.
So in one article, you were asked about the early days of Oppenheimer, and you said that Marty had came down with a case of biographer's disease.
Yes. Well, this is common. Biography is really a obsessive profession. It's unlike history, because it is about one person and you become obsessed, wanting to know more and more about this person's journey. And there's always one more archive to visit and one more interview that you think needs to be done. And you're searching for, that mysterious diary item or that one letter that will explain the personality or the crucial decision that took your subject in a different direction. And because it's about one person, there's also sort of this feeling, this obligation to get it right. I've started out writing about people like McCloy or McGeorge Bundy, who I thought deserved to be criticized. These were powerful white men, rulers of the American establishment. And in the case of both McCloy and Mac Bundy, I thought they were responsible in some way for the war in Vietnam, that terrible episode in American history. And yet, when I got into it, I spent years trying to figure out why these smart liberal men had made such bad decisions. I really sort of bent over backwards to be fair to McGeorge Bundy, although in the end, it's a pretty tough assessment. Anyway, biography is, it's a mysterious process. It really seduces you into trying to figure out the truth. And of course, the truth is always kind of elusive
And always gray.
and always gray.
Yeah. So now in Oppenheimer, you must have, Marty's telling you that there's still more research to be done. And it turns out the problem wasn't that there wasn't enough research. The problem was that the analysis and the actual getting down to the writing. So, I mean, did you have like one dinner conversation where you said, enough? Marty, I just got to tell you, there's a book here. Or did you just start writing and start sending him chapters?
Marty was eager to sort of get it done by the year 2000. So I joined him. I spent a year thinking about it and weighing whether I could risk doing another co-authorship. But I did join him. We got a new contract. And then Marty started sending me boxes. And, I was overwhelmed. And every few months, he would find several more boxes in his closet or attic that he had forgotten about, literally. And I told him, listen, Marty, I'm just going to try to start writing a chapter on the childhood years of Robert Oppenheimer. And I sent him a quick draft, and that stimulated him to start. He started to rewrite it, and it turned into a fabulous collaboration because I thought the research was done and I was happy to just sit and write. And Marty would look at what I had written and he would see all the gaps and the holes. And he was so familiar with the research that he would then go in and add material and often, completely rewrite it. And so it went relatively quickly. I joined him in 2000 and we had a full manuscript by 2004, and the book was published in 2005, a very long, 720 pages of printed narrative, plus all the footnotes.
Oh, there are two great stories in it. One is the making of the bomb, and the second is the persecution of Oppenheimer.
No, at one point in the writing, Marty sort of made a point of turning to me and saying, Kai, you and I wouldn't be spending all these years writing on this book on Oppenheimer if it was just a story about the making of the atomic bomb, this weapon of mass destruction. What gave it the story a arc is that, he was this great hero at the end of World War II, America's most famous scientist, father of the atomic bomb. And then 9 years later, he's destroyed and humiliated in this secret kangaroo court of a trial and brought down. And that gives the story a tragic element that is compelling and a mystery.
Did you ever have a clash with Marty over was he or was he not a communist, or what exactly did he contribute at Los Alamos? I mean, were there issues that you had to fight about and then resolve one way or the other?
We would go for long walks and sort of debate the evidence. And there are still mysteries. You read that book today, and it's a book about a very mysterious fellow who, as a young man, had a very prolonged, difficult adolescence, some kind of nervous breakdown, what we call in the poison apple incident. We knew something terrible had happened to the young Oppenheimer in England, and when he was struggling to get his PhD. He had some kind of nervous breakdown, and we're not exactly sure because the records were destroyed at Cambridge. But something did happen to cause him to go see a series of psychiatrists, and likewise, there are other mysteries in his life. The mystery of how he could have gone from simply managing a half dozen graduate students at Berkeley and then suddenly be appointed to become the manager director of this secret city in Los Alamos, managing 6,000 people. But we argued that he was capable of transforming himself in a very unusual way. Likewise, we argued the Communist Party membership. We would debate among ourselves the evidence. There was a lot of circumstantial evidence about how close Oppie was to the party. His brother Frank was a member. Kitty, his wife, had once been a member. His first fiancee, Jane Tatlock, was a member of the party. He certainly gave plenty of money to Communist Party causes like the Spanish Republic. But in the end, you look at the FBI documents, his file is 8,000 pages. And it was the job of the FBI to prove if he was a member of the party. And there's all this circumstantial evidence and intriguing evidence, but no smoking gun. So Marty and I concluded in the end that you have to look at the whole man. That's really the biographer's responsibility, to not get lost in the forest and see only the individual trees, but to see the whole forest. And we just thought this is not the kind of man who would subject himself to party discipline. He was an independent intellectual. He was a free thinker. He was very provocative, very charismatic, and he had an enormous ego. And he clashed with authority figures in his life. So it made no sense that he would take orders from a little committee in Berkeley about what to do. But to answer your question in the end, yes, of course, Marty and I debated all sorts of issues in the biography, but we had fun doing it. It was, nothing ever became cantankerous or difficult.
I imagine it could be stimulating.
Yeah, it was fun.
I guess the greatest collaboration of your wife is Susan, but this other great collaboration, Christopher Nolan calls you up and says, "Hey, I want to make a movie." Were you on the outside for that, or did you have his ear steering him towards what eventually became this great film?
Well, this was very much Christopher Nolan's film. By the time he called me in September of 21, he'd already written a full script. And he had done so sort of on spec, just to see if he could do it. Someone had given him the book in March of 21. He sat down and read it and fell in love with it and started taking notes on it and reread it again. And without calling up me or Marty, he did take the step to establish that the film option was available. But Christopher wasn't sure he could do it. It's unlike any of his other films. It was a biopic in the sense that he was trying to tackle. And he was basing it entirely on this one book. And so when he called in September of 21, he asked for a meeting. He explained he was picking up the film option, and I took the train up to New York to see him. Unfortunately, Marty couldn't come on that trip because by that time he was too ill. He had been struggling with small cell lung cancer for 2 years, and he was deteriorating rapidly. So he couldn't travel. So I went up, took the meetings. And at that point, Nolan said he wasn't prepared to share with me the script. But we had a long conversation about what was in the script and what wasn't. And I had taken Susan along with me, knowing that she would interrogate him. And she did. And we learned more. And I came back and reported to Marty that I thought Nolan was really emotionally intelligent and unlike our stereotypes of Hollywood directors, he was smart and sensitive, and he had really understood the book. So I was hopeful. And then Marty died 2 weeks after that meeting. But about 3 months later, I got another call from Nolan, and he invited me to meet with him again. And this time he wanted to share with me the finished script. And this was about a month before he was going to start shooting. So obviously he was concerned to make sure that there were no historical inaccuracies. He took license. He made up conversations between Einstein and Oppenheimer that were not witnessed by anyone else, but they were, not improbable conversations. He sat me in a hotel room in Greenwich Village and, said, "Here's the script. Take as long as you need to read it." And it took me 4 hours. It's a 180-page film script. And it was an emotionally moving moment, those hours. It just brought back all this flood of memories about writing the book. And I kept thinking, what would Marty think of this scene or that? But I was blown away by it. I thought it was a wonderful script. I was trying to imagine what it would look like on the big screen. And at the same time, I was trying to focus, are there any historical inaccuracies? I found one where in the script he had Oppenheimer being questioned in the security hearing about how many people had died as a result of the atomic bomb that you had built. And Oppie's answer was 70,000, 70. And when I went down to tell Christopher Nolan my reaction to the script, and I said, "Well, there's one thing I found," and I described this. He immediately interrupted me and said, "Yes, I know that's wrong. And I'm trying to fix it." But he pointed out that that was what Oppenheimer's answer was in the transcript of the security hearing. So he had actually, done some close reading of his own. And he did fix it because most historians think that the answer should be at least double that, around 140,000 or even 240,000 lives lost in the two cities. So he has Oppenheimer saying both things in the actual movie. Anyway, he's very sensitive. I had met one suggestion for him in the script, and he accepted it. And otherwise, when I finally saw the film, he flew me out to LA and walked me into absolutely empty IMAX theater and sat me in the middle, at his favorite seat right in the middle. And then he walked away to the end of the aisle and let me see this thing all by myself.
Wow.
It was an incredible. I was weeping by the end. Again, sort of thinking of what Marty would have thought and what he had missed by dying at the young age of 84. Then I had to get up and tell Nolan what I thought. So I wandered down to the end of the aisle, and I gave him a big hug and whispered in his ear, "It's brilliant." Then I turned to his wife, Emma, who is his producer, and said, "Emma, most authors all invariably say that the book is always better than the film. And my fear is that many people are going to see this film and think that the film is much better than the book." And I was being a little diplomatic, but they laughed and assured me that that wasn't the case.
My own two cents is that both of them are masterpieces in their own genre. And you get the Pulitzer Prize. You become the director of the Leon Levy Center. You win the Bio Award from the nation's fellow biographers. And you get to go out to Hollywood and watch this film win an Oscar. And this all comes at the very young age of XX. But you know, what is it like to have this rush of success when you've been laboring in the vineyard so long?
Well, I think it was a good thing. It's sort of weird that this book that came out in 2005 and sold rather modestly, it did win the Pulitzer, but it still didn't get on the bestseller list anywhere. And then suddenly, you know, all these years later, it's turned into a movie and suddenly finds a vast new audience of readers. But I think if it had happened at the time, I think I would have been diverted, and I never would have written all the books I've written since Oppenheimer.
Interesting. So you would have been Carl Bernstein instead of Bob Woodward.
Yeah, right. I think I learned long ago that you really write for yourself, and that the biographer's journey is so long and so lonely that you just have to be satisfied with satisfying yourself.
So right now you're working on Roy Cohn. How is that going, and why make that choice? Is it connected to the age of Trump?
Well, I landed on Roy Cohn more than 2 years ago, signed a contract with Scribner's to do Roy Cohn. And I had to write a 40-page proposal. I had to convince some editors that this was worth doing. I actually encountered a lot of doubts, some questions about whether this was a book that would find an audience, whether people still remembered who Roy Cohn was. So, you know, I've been working on it more than 2 years now. And in the last 6 months, very uncharacteristically, I have been writing up a storm. Usually I plod along at about 300 words a day at best. But in the last 6 months, I've written 72,000 words.
Ouch.
Covering the years 1927 to about 1969. And he dies in 1986, so more than halfway, maybe. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. It is turning out, with the results of the November election, to be a much more relevant subject than when I started out, because of Trump, because Roy Cohn made Trump as a young man. He was his lawyer and mentor and taught him how to deal with the press and the courts. And it's a very insidious story. But Roy Cohn is a very dark subject. But my job as the biographer is still to humanize him, not just paint him as this stick figure of an evil actor in American history, but to explain how this very closeted gay man, who was also a very famous public figure at the age of 26, at the height of the McCarthy hearings, how he could, you know, remain a public figure and still remain in the closet, I think explains a lot about his bad behavior. Anyway, I'm having fun with it. And like all biography, it's a treasure hunt. And I should say my major breakthrough at this point is that 2 years ago when I started, I filed a FOIA request to the FBI for Roy Cohn's FBI file. And it turns out that there are 10,000 pages. And initially the FBI refused to process the file. So I sued them. I got the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press in Washington, D.C. to pro bono take on the case. And within 3 months, the FBI folded and they agreed to process all 10,000 pages at a rate of about 500 pages a month. So I now have about 6,000 pages and more to come. And it's fabulous material. It's
I think that's the best lesson for a young biographer that's going to come out of this podcast is, don't take no for an answer. Congratulations. That's excellent work. So you went from the saintly Jimmy Carter to the evil Roy Cohn, which is a great example of the breadth of biography. From your position in the Levy Center, how do you see the craft going right now, especially among the young folks that are coming through the center?
Biography is in a very good state. It's still a very captivating form of history. So it's very competitive. There are a lot of good projects out there. And despite the fact that it's such a difficult art, that it takes so much time and the research seems to be endless, there are still plenty of people who become biographers. And so I think that's a good thing. And publishers are still willing to step up and publish long books. And oddly enough, publishing is always in crisis. It was in crisis 30 years ago. It's in crisis today. And yet, publishers still sign up biographers to do big, fat, complicated lives of fascinating people. And readers sort of are, I think, wrongly think that books are expensive. They are, in fact, the cheapest form of entertainment. Even if it's a $35, $40 book, it provides hours and hours of diversion. And readers expect, they actually, for a biography, they want a long book. They want to know as much as possible about their subject. So I think biography is in a good state, and it's not confined any longer to just powerful white men like I wrote about, but it's become much more diverse. Biographers are tackling unknown subjects, and that's all to the good.
Terrific. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Jack.
That was award-winning author Kai Bird speaking with fellow biographer Jack Farrell. This interview was recorded via Zoom on December 9th of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.